All right, we are back with another episode of Lions Collective. I'm your host, Jeff Ifrady from Crunch Time Sports. To my right, Justin Rogers, Detroit Football Network. We got Colton Pouncey from The Athletic. And, of course, Will Birchfield in the insane asylum room. we are all here to recap Lions Browns, get into some of the injuries that occurred, obviously, from that game itself. We got more information from it now that it's Wednesday. We're going to get Nolee McNeal. We got things from the game itself. And then we're going to preview later, of course, Lions Bengals. So we got a packed show today, fellas. Packed show.
Packed.
Yeah.
Let's rip.
Well, I'll say this just to kind of intro this game from Sunday here, because I just, and we can get quick thoughts before we get, because I know the people want to hear about the injuries. That's obviously the biggest storyline. I'll just say the Lions don't get enough credit. I know locally, obviously, they get, they've been getting a lot of love and credit, but they take care of teams they're supposed to beat. We got to see the Packers over the last 2 weeks, who right away after week one, you know, many, and again, I still think they're a good team, but they lose to the Browns, and, you know, they have a shootout with the Cowboys ending a tie 40-40, which how many times do you see 40-40 ties in the NFL? But then you have
never, in fact.
Yeah, it's crazy. Scoregami. But then you have the Lions, who take care of teams they're supposed to beat. So it's like the Browns, they didn't play their best game offensively, but they dominated defensively. And offensively, they still scored, what, 27 points with the help of Cleef Raymond adding another 7 from special teams. So it was a good win, no matter who they faced. Great win. They took care of business.
I think that's what good teams always do, you know, and I constantly use this comparison to the Patriots and their dynasty just because it's fresh and I'm not going back to the 50s because I don't know what I'm talking about. But, like, that was what the Patriots did. They – every single week you'd look at the matchup and you go – yeah, that's a team they're going to take care of. And, you know, maybe it wasn't always pretty, but they got the job done. And Campbell described it this week, Dan Campbell, as finding different ways to win and to get the job done, because that's what this league takes. This isn't, you know, an SEC team versus a midseason non-conference game where they could just steamroll the opponent with the backups. Like, every team has quality talent. That Browns team, that Browns roster had quality talent in a lot of different spots, mostly defensively, but you know, a few offensive pieces as well. And you still have to find a way to get it done when it's not pretty. And not only did it get done, they won by you know, a pretty comfortable margin. And that's kind of what this team is about, and you know why, you know, I think ultimately they're a good team.
Yeah, I think I said there are worse Sundays to be had than the 24-point win. You know, I think a lot of teams around the league would take that. And that's sort of where the Lions are at this point, where, like, you can win 34-10. You can win by 24 and, you know, make it look good in the end and still feel a certain type of way about some of the things in that game and say, oh, that's going to cost us against a better team. That's where the mindset needs to be, I think, for this squad and where they're at in year 5 under Dan Campbell. So, yeah, you know, obviously a good win. I think you feel good about it. You know, it was close there until the fourth quarter and they broke things open a little bit there. But yeah, certainly I think they knew it wasn't going to be a clean game, so to speak. Not when you're facing a defense like that, which we can get into later. But yeah, if you can walk away with a win like that, again, like Justin said, this is not college football, even though in some ways it kind of felt like a college game for me. I covered my first year covering Michigan State. I think that offense was ranked 126th in college football in scoring, and their defense was top 5. So it kind of felt like that for me, at least. But in the NFL, you know, these teams have talent, and you know, even a guy like Quinshon Judkins, I thought he was awesome in that game. I know they're kind of feeding him a lot, but they've got some talent over there. It's just, you know, got to get that quarterback situation figured out. And I think the Lions are pretty lucky they have a good guy in their end. But yeah, certainly in the NFL, there are really no easy games. And, you know, even a game like that, where you win by 24, you're going to have some struggles along the way just because this is a league like that.
That was a good year for Michigan State's offense, all the way up to 126.
Yeah, right.
Hey, I'm a Boston College fan. I'm allowed to take shots. We also suck, for the record. So don't be offended, all the Sparty fans out there. I think what this Lions team has evolved to piggyback off Colton's point, is they can play a game where their offense largely struggles and their defense plays well enough to allow for a 24-point win. And we saw shades of this last year before those injuries wrecked almost all of the starting lineup. We saw it, I think, in week 3 in Arizona on a day the offense was very stop and start. The defense won them that game. We saw it a little bit in Indy on a day the offense was trying to find its footing. The defense won them that game. But we saw it at its best for the first time last Sunday when, you know, the Browns defensive front was as advertised and the Lions had to benefit from some good field position, had to benefit from a big return from Khalif Raymond to put points on the board. And yet the defense was just as stout, if not stingier, than Cleveland's. And they got the takeaways that Cleveland didn't. And you know, we're watching this defense begin to carry its weight in a way that it hasn't in the past. And that's what makes this team feel different. And it's why their ceiling feels even higher than it felt last year by the end of the season. Obviously, there were some injuries that came with it last week on defense. But, man, you look at this unit from front to back, and especially now in the middle with those three linebackers playing as well as any linebacking trio in the NFL, and you get a sense of how imposing this defense can be when they're on the field. Like, it's rare in the NFL to see – three linebackers play almost every single snap of a game. It's rare across football now. Like, that's just not how defenses can respond to the way that offenses are playing more and more of a pass-centric game. But with this defense and the athleticism and versatility that Anzalone, Barnes, and Campbell all bring, they can do it. And it seems like Shep is kind of building this unit around those three, and it's paying dividends so far.
The linebacker building around the linebackers. It's funny because I'm going to go back to college here for me, and it's a little bit longer than you three, but like, so 2003, 2004, you know, the Lions game would be popped on in the dorm rooms or whatever. And we'd play this game like that. They'd be close. The Lions would be close. And it was, how were they going to blow it? You know, what were they going to do? How many plays into this drive is John Kitna going to throw an interception? And when are we going to hear Mark Champion with his depressing Lions blow it call? Like, that was just part of who this team was. Like, did anybody in this collective here, let's see what I did there. did you ever think the Lions were going to lose this game? You know, even when they give up a touchdown on the first drive, or when it's the Browns have a field goal kick to bring it within one score there kind of in the middle of the second half. Like, at no point did you think they were going to lose this game. Like, this is a team now that even when it's close and it's ugly, you expect them to grind it out, to pull it out, to be the other side of that equation. And, you know, obviously this wasn't a game they had to grind out. It was pretty decisive in the end, but at no point did I think the Browns were going to upend the Lions. Like, it's just, That's unrealistic with where this roster and this team is versus where that team is.
Yeah, some of that had to do with Joe Flacco in my mind, but yes, I tend to agree with
all
you.
Of it, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, when you're watching that game, there was no panic whatsoever on the sideline, in the press box for us watching. Like, that felt like one that they were going to find a way to kind of kick the door down at some point and blow it open, and they did. And they got it from in different ways, with turnovers, with you know, special teams return. And that's what you can come to expect from this group. They play complementary football, and not a lot of teams can say that. A lot of teams are, you know, one-sided. They play really good defense, but they're terrible on offense, or vice versa, or sometimes terrible at both. But the Lions have pretty good pieces all around, and this is a football team. It's not just a collection of parts. This is a football team, and it shows in games like this.
The other thing you can always count on this team doing, if we leave week one out of this conversation, is finding a way to run the ball, even if it's trying at times, and even if it's taxing at times, and even if over the first quarter or first half, the numbers don't look pretty. By the end of the day, you'll look up, and they will have rushed for probably 100-plus yards, and at least close to, on a bad day, 4 yards per carry. I mean, like, take Jahmyr Gibbs's day. He rushes for almost 100 yards by himself. I think he accounted for, on Sunday, the three longest runs the Browns have allowed this season to any running back. I think five of the six longest runs they've allowed to any running back. And it was not pleasing to the eye for part of the day. Even you could go so far as to say for most of the day, but they will keep pounding away and finding a way to break through. And he also would have had probably a 35-yard touchdown if not for a tripping call on the Brown safety. But this offense is stubborn in a productive way sometimes, and they will not abandon the run game because they know how essential it is to their entire operation.
I'd go as far as to say you would add an 85-yard touchdown if J-Mo holds up on a perimeter block. Like, they're that close where they're, you know, that was a good run performance against a great run defense. It could have been another Baltimore-esque performance with just a couple small things going their way.
And I want to add, they had that success, you know, relative success against this Browns front that was giving up, I think, 57.3 yards, yeah, rushing yards per game. They had 109, I believe, and that's, you know, a couple plays in there. Kyle Allen takes a couple knees, whatever.
Sure.
To kind of add to it. But I would like to add that the Browns stacked the box. They had eight men or more in the box about 60% of the time against the Lions, and they still had that sort of success. So I think if you put that into context, that's a really good day against a Browns defense that was trying to stop the run, and you still did pretty well against them. So, hats off to the Lions. And for John Morton for, you know, having his guys kind of back up his words. Hey, we got a pretty good front on the head too. So, good day all around for them.
Yeah, it's credit. Also, I mean, we talk about this offensive line. I know Will brought up last week about if they don't allow a sack this week, Will, what would happen and how historic that would be. They did not allow a sack, although I might add there's a little bit of context to that. Obviously, Jared Goff says, I think his ability to move within the pocket deserves some praise because it's not like Myles Garrett wasn't back there. They just couldn't get to Jared Goff, but they didn't allow a sack. They were able to run the ball. It seems like this offensive line now, post week one, after that Green Bay Packers game, and they looked really bad, they've done everything correct since then. They've looked like a unit that has, it seems to have the chemistry, obviously the talent that is gelling together. And you saw Tate Ratledge in the assignment he had a lot of that game going after Mason Graham, who's a rookie, but a very good rookie. Tate Ratledge held his own, dude. Mm-hmm. It was very, very good. So credit to the offensive line for another really good performance. I mean, you talk about stacking the box. Those guys up front went to work, and it helped out definitely offensively. Although they didn't play their best, they held up. And that's a pretty good defensive front from the Browns.
It's really good defensive front. That's probably one of the three or four best defensive fronts in the NFL. I credit in particular to Taylor Decker, who is clearly not playing at 100% right now, didn't even practice last week, but got himself comfortable enough to play on Sunday. And then, not that this was the game plan, wound up on islands quite often, more than even he or the Lions anticipated, against Myles Garrett, and more than held his own. And I know the PFF grades might not be all that favorable to him or to anyone on the offensive line, but I wish PFF grades would come with some context, or could grade players on a curve, because when you allow four quarterback pressures and no sacks and you spent most of your day taking on Myles Garrett, like, dude, that's an A. Like, and I'm not even being facetious here. And I was asking Decker about this today. Like, do you grade yourself differently when you go back and watch the film and you're taking on Myles Garrett one-on-one most of the time versus Joe Schmo, a run-of-the-mill pass rusher in a different game? And in Decker's long-winded way, he said, yeah, like I that is, if you apply what I did on Sunday to almost any other opponent, no, that is not up to my standard. But when you're playing, in his words, an Avenger, yeah, that's going to be good enough to get the job done. And he was honest with, like, we had a game plan for Myles Garrett that involved sending more help my way, Panay's way, and there were cases that he was lined up against him. And as the game evolved, we just kind of strayed from it. And so it was me versus Myles Garrett for most of that day. And Taylor Decker did the job, man. He really did. And I would also like to point out on Jared, yes, he has clearly improved with his maneuverability in the pocket. And I even went up to him today after his scrum, and I just wanted to tell him, like, dude, I'll be honest, Jared, I am someone who has been sarcastic and even flippant at times about your athleticism and your perceived lack of mobility. But I just want to tell you, like, I've been genuinely impressed this season at watching you kind of control and navigate the pocket. And he appreciated it. And it was a way for me to ask him, like, just, have you done anything differently to enhance that area of your game, especially this offseason? And he was adamant, like, no, I haven't. I've just continued to work on it and work on it. The one thing that he always points out, and this goes back a couple of years now, but it seems truer now than ever, is that when your offensive line consistently pass protects well, you know exactly when things break down because it's so rare. And then you know how to evade the pressure when you need to. It's like, you know, look, you take an average quarterback in the NFL playing behind an average offensive line, they might drop back 10 times and face pressure 8 times. And so they don't really know when they need to scramble, when they need to chuck it away, when they can take an extra half second or an extra second. Whereas for me, I can drop back 10 times and I can count on that pocket being clean, perfectly clean, 6 out of those 10 or 8 out of those 10. And so on the couple times that it's not, you know, like, he pointed out a play, the third down throw to St. Brown, where Myles Garrett came around the right edge and Jared just took a little neat step up into the pocket, evaded the pressure, kind of rolled out and hit St. Brown for a first down. He was like, that's the only time all game that Panay got edged. And so when Panay gets edged, I know that's a problem in this case. I'll step up and go find my guy. So it's a credit certainly to Jared's sneaky maneuverability, but also to his offensive line for being so reliable that in the rare instances where they aren't, he knows that it's time to use his feet and navigate that trouble.
It's a chemistry thing, right? Like, we talk about chemistry between the left guard and the left tackle or the center and the right guard. Like, they know each other's strengths. They know where they need to compensate for each other's weaknesses. That extends to the quarterback too. Like, Goff knows where some of these matchups are going to be unfavorable to maybe an individual or the collective of the offensive line, and is aware of that. You know, he's seen enough. That's like anything else. Like, you have so much experience banked on top of the chemistry that, yeah, he's not getting more athletic at this stage of his career. He just has a better sense of when or where to move. He has a better feel for the pressure before it arrives, and that's showing up in a really positive way.
I thought that was a really thoughtful response from Goff, just talking about, hey, well, my situation is a little bit different, so I notice the pressure when it's there because I don't get a ton of it. But at the same time, I want to give Goff some credit because he takes hits, man. Mm. Like, he's tough in the pocket. Like, he knows – hey, on this play, it's going to be a long developing route. I have to wait in here and kind of let it rip when it comes. And I might get a hit here. I might take a shot. And if that happens, I'm going to bounce right back up. And he's done that time and time again this season. He has maneuvered the pocket. But even when he does have to stand in there knowing he's going to take a hit, he takes it, man. And that's an impressive trait because a lot of quarterbacks are complaining. They're looking for a call from the refs. I think Jared probably deserves some more calls than he honestly gets during games. I think he should probably do that a little bit more.
Yeah.
But he's not one to complain about anything. He's just going to let it rip, sit in there as long as it takes, wait for his receiver to come in, let it rip. And if he has to take a shot, he takes a shot, but he gets right back up. So just the confidence that he has in the pocket, I think he's one of the best pocket passers in the NFL at this point. And I turned to somebody during the game. Maybe it was you, Justin, or someone else, but like, sometimes he looks like Tom Brady back there, the way he stands tall in the pocket and is waiting for his guys to come open.
You just gave Mustafa a headline.
I'm sure I did. But he does sometimes. When you're watching him, you're right. There's not a lot of pure pocket passers in the NFL anymore. It's kind of like a throwback trait. But when you watch him stand in there and deliver the football accurately and on time, like, it's kind of like a lost art. And so, yeah, hat tip to Jared for standing in there as often as he does and as well as he does. I think that's an underrated part of his game that doesn't get a lot of love.
The other thing that he does really, really well is live to fight another down. And if the pocket is collapsing on him and he can sense that he's about to get sacked, he knows he can't evade those edge rushers. He is very self-aware, and he'll chuck the ball away or he'll ground the ball to a running back's feet to avoid the 7-yard loss that honestly a more athletic and scramble inclined quarterback might take because they think they can evade that pressure. And so you don't see the Lions facing many second and 16s or third and 12s because Jared is really aware of when the pressure is folding in and how to avoid those sacks. And that's, I think, a really underrated part of his game. There were a number of plays on Sunday where he was less than a half second away from taking what would have been a 6 or 7 yard loss, but he can feel it and he can get rid of the ball when he needs to keep the offense at least on schedule. And he talks about when he says we, he's referring to the other quarterbacks that don't have the ability to elude edge rushers. And he's like, we know who we are. We know what we have to do. And part of being a quarterback with that physical profile is ditching the ball when you have to. And I think that's another underrated trait of his that has developed more and more over the course of his career.
Yeah, I mean, we could stick with the offense because I do want to bring up something that did happen in that game that included Goff, but it was more so just the connection between Goff and Jameson Williams, which, you know, I do want to preface and just state this. The Jameson Williams thing, I don't know if people are making a big deal about it or not. I think just my take on it, and I'd love to know your guys' confidence in him kind of moving forward, because it should be, I think, what it already was before the game. I don't think much should change. I think it came down to a simple fact of they just were not on the same page. Jameson Williams, it's already been stated by Dan Campbell, we're so lucky, not he didn't say this, but I'll just say this, we're so lucky that we get to see Amon-Ra St. Brown catch everything that's thrown at him. I think Jared Goff throwing to Amon-Ra St. Brown has a completion percentage of like 80-something percent. So we're lucky to get to see his hands, that I think every time we see, you know, J-Mo drop a ball, that I think inherently we're just programmed to be like, oh, that's weird, because we're so used to Amon-Ra catching everything. Dan's already stated, man, like he's not going to have those type of hands, but he also has God-given abilities when it comes to his speed and what he can do in terms of being explosive. He obviously did not have a great day. He had a really bad drop down the sideline, which I will say, just to compliment Goff again, an absolute dot that was dropped by James, an absolute dot right in the bucket. And there was just some plays that were, it just seemed like they weren't on the same page. But just for your guys' standpoint, what's kind of your confidence moving forward, especially a good matchup this weekend, I believe, in the Bengals, to kind of get this chemistry and Jameson Williams back on track here, get his confidence up?
Scotty Montgomery kind of confirmed what I was thinking today and you know, kind of asked him the question to see if we're on the same page. But, you know, 2 years ago, you know, I thought Williams was the type that let a bad moment snowball, and you'd even see it in a solitary training camp practice, one bad drop, one bad read, and like suddenly the whole practice would kind of go off the rails for him, because he would just, I don't know, get in his own head. And maturity is a really broad thing, you know, getting and growing in your maturity or becoming more mature. And I think Williams' ability to shake the bad moments, to have that memory of a goldfish, whatever cliche you want to use for NFL players, where they have to be able to move on to the next play and not let the last one beat them a second time. Like, I don't know if he's all the way there, but he's certainly at a stage now where you're not, worried about it consuming him. And, you know, what Scotty said was the way J-Mo came into the building Monday with this attitude of getting it right, getting it corrected, moving forward, was something that probably wasn't there 2 years ago. And so, yeah, you know, for that reason, I think this is a player that, no, I'm not worried about it. Dan Campbell had a great kind of, I don't know if you want to call it an excuse, explanation, whatever. They didn't practice on Wednesday. They had a walkthrough. They scratched the practice because of the Monday night game the previous week, just to let the guys breathe a little bit. And that limits your ability to iron out the details, to get the reps. And they were just a little bit off. There's no doubt about it. Whether it was J-Mo dropping one or Jared placing one in a wrong spot, like the connection was just a little bit off all day. And so I have very, very little concern that this snowballs beyond a 1 week thing.
Yeah, me neither. And I kind of broke down all six incompletions to J-Mo in that game for a story. Just watched the film. And I had a couple takeaways. I charted on five of those six pass attempts, Goff had pressure in his face. And again, the sacks, there weren't any sacks in that game, but he was facing pressure. And I think the Lions knew that going in. But what I would say is, when you're watching those plays, it's like if they had just like 0.2 seconds longer, so one of those at least is a touchdown, or, you know, you're waiting for J-Mo to come open and it's almost there. But that's the difference in the NFL sometimes when you're watching these teams play and going against a talented defense like the Browns there. So, yeah, I asked Campbell about it, and he said, look, it's just a little bit off. Like, if J-Mo gets his head around earlier or, you know, something just a little bit off is kind of what he was saying. And he also kind of took responsibility, saying, look, we had the short week. Yeah. We were trying to install third down on one day, and I think Wednesday was like a walkthrough. So, like, you're trying to cram some stuff in. So he kind of looked in the mirror and said, you know, maybe I can take some stuff off their plate a little bit. But then when you talk to players, and Jared spoke today, I think the play that everyone's talking about is you know, the drop might have been a touchdown if JMO catches it, or at least a, you know, long gain, right? His momentum's kind of taken towards the sideline. I think what Jared said is he missed it on that.
Yeah.
He said, I think I missed it a little bit outside. And I think if he was able to come up with that, it would have been him kind of saving my ass to some extent, making that play. So Jared actually took responsibility for that one. I believe he took responsibility on the interception because you see the Browns corner kind of dropping into that deep third. I don't think Jared expected him to be there. I think he thought that he was in man coverage. So Jared made a couple mistakes in that game that, you know, JMO might get some heat for. But JMO did have the crucial drop the second time around. That was on him. That probably would have been a walk-in touchdown when he runs sort of the shallow crosser, takes it upfield a little bit, and Jared kind of escapes the pocket. That probably would have been a touchdown. That one I think is fair to blame on JMO. But when I'm watching that, I'm like, Cleveland's playing some really good defense here. You know, it's good coverage. You know, they had the free play that JMO really wasn't looking for. So like some of the stuff you're watching back and you're like, I can see why it got to that point. But I really think a couple things is the pressure. Cause even on one of those passes, like Jared got hit. I don't know if people saw that. It was like Malik Collins got his hand in there. You know, Myles Garrett was kind of pushing Taylor back into Jared's hip and he didn't really have time to throw that one deep the way he wanted to. So I don't hate the game plan because they knew they were playing a Browns defense that plays the most man coverage in the NFL. They knew that they were trying to take away Amon-Ra St. Brown over the middle of the field where he runs those crossers. He runs the dig. That's a sort of a staple of this offense. They were giving him extra attention with the linebacker, bringing a safety down. They were trying to take him out of the game plan is what I saw watching that back. And that gave JMO those one-on-one opportunities downfield. And that's what Campbell said. We were looking to hit on those. If you hit just one of those downfield, you're feeling a lot better about that game. And instead of us, you know, talking about it now, a couple of days after the fact. I mean, I think it's sort of circumstance. You're playing against good defense. You're playing against a defense where those looks are going to be there more often than they normally might against a team that plays a lot more zone. So they were trying to take advantage and didn't work. And a couple factors played into that. But what I liked about sort of, you know, the aftermath of that is even when they weren't connecting, they were still going to him. Jared, maybe a couple years ago, if JMO drops a pass or, you know, one bounces off his fingers, he's going to Laporta or Saint or just forcing it to someone else instead of going to JMO again. But he kept coming back to him because that's sort of where they're at this stage in their careers. Jared said he's one of the best weapons in the NFL and he's going to try to get him the ball anytime he thinks he has a good look. So that's sort of where they're at. And I have no concerns about that duo moving forward. I think they'll be just fine.
Yeah,
super quick. Shout out their other Miles Harden, the nickel corner, probably one guy we were not talking about at all going into this game. Given all their, he had a couple reps against JMO where he was there like the duration of the field, jammed him once, disrupting a timing route. That guy probably had a decent film session on Monday. That's for sure.
Yeah, when you run the sort of route tree that JMO runs, which involves a lot of lower probability throws than someone that, say, St. Brown runs, you're just going to run into days like this. And I know Scotty Montgomery didn't want to chalk it up to one of those days. And we talked about specifically on the dropped deep ball, you know, maybe we can have higher hands at the point of the catch. So we're catching that ball up near our eyes instead of letting it come down over our shoulder and then kind of escape our vision down by our waist. So he seized on some things that JMO could have done better as a receiver, especially at the point of the catch. But, you know, when you have days where you put up 108 yards on two catches, because that's the role you play in this offense, you're also going to have days where a couple of those throws don't hit and you go home with two catches on seven targets and a bunch of us still talking about it on Wednesday. So that's kind of the nature of the role that JMO plays in this offense. And it was good to see them connect on that crosser later in the game on kind of a higher percentage throw. But this is the reality of the role that he plays. And I expect him to bounce back and don't expect there to be any lingering issues between JMO and Jared.
Yeah, before we get to the injuries, which we will, I just want to mention credit again, a massive game for Aiden Hutchinson. I mean, if I'm Aiden, you got to go talk to Brian Branch after the game. I mean, he should have had three sacks and two forced fumbles in that game, man. Like three sacks, two forced fumbles would have been the best defensive performance in the entire season for the NFL. I mean, it was still up there. Two sacks, a forced fumble, obviously, for Aiden. You're starting to now see what you guys reported on during training camp, which, you know, obviously – during training camp, he was dominating, you know, whoever it was, Dan Skipper or Giovanni Manu, but he was also getting Penei Sewell as well. People forget that. He was having a one hell of a training camp, and then week one happens. The whole team just doesn't really show up. And ever since then, he has 4 sacks in 4 games. He's a favorite, one of the favorites, along with Myles Garrett and Micah Parsons, ironically with the Packers, to win Defensive Player of the Year. So Aiden, and he has a pretty favorable matchup this week against the Bengals, who just can't seem to block anything. So for Aiden, he's having an incredible year. He's on pace for what, close to 20 sacks. And I don't care who he's facing, if it's backup tackles or not. If he doesn't have the production, people are still going to find ways to critique him. So Aiden, monster game, and he's only probably going to continue this.
Dude, now,
you're going to have to give him the blank check. You're just
Brian Branch is racking up some debts to pay in that locker room. He now owes. He owes Tarion for the interception that he robbed him of against the Bears. He told me he owes Jack Campbell for sticking his cleat in his mouth when he got his lip cut open. And I asked Brian last week, I was like, what are you going to get Jack as a sort of token of apology? And he was like, I don't know, man, it's a surprise. I'm still cooking it up. So, and now he might also owe Hutch. So for as well as he's played, he's kind of wronged his teammates along the way. He's going to have to right those wrongs.
He's a master of friendly fire.
Yeah.
There is a non-zero chance that Hutchinson actually did go up to Brian Branch and make him apologize for robbing him of a forced fumble. But
yeah, he said, hey, here's an invoice from the House of Hutch.
Exactly. You got to buy 50 shirts and bring up our tally in the fourth field merchandise stand. I don't understand how anybody schemes to leave an elite edge rusher alone. And that extends to Myles Garrett. And who schemed up Cornelius Lucas to be one-on-one with Aiden Hutchinson? Like,
Cornelius Lucas.
what malpractice? Like, I've always laughed at the idea of coaching. That's coaching malpractice. You see Hutchinson in a 4-point stance, just ready to explode off the line. And there's nothing Lucas can do. Just nothing. The guy's been in the league 12 years, seen it all, and it doesn't matter. Nothing he can do. And, you know, when it gets to that point where, you know, people are voting for Defensive Player of the Year, they're not going to remember that Aiden Hutchinson did this against Cornelius Lucas. They're going to remember they had 2 sacks and a forced fumble in a victory, right? Like, that's how that is interpreted. So, you know, I walked away from that game going, damn, Hutch is really good. He's always really good. And I also walked away going, Myles Garrett's still a little bit better, right? Yeah. Like, just the way he defends the run and the all-round player he is, you know, Hutch is still a junior Avenger, if you will. But he's working his way up. He'll get his Captain America shield at some point, but you know, still just a half tick below whatever Garrett's eating over there in Cleveland.
He's a beast, man. We're going to get to the injuries. I do want to get to that because that's what people want to hear about. Before we do that, I have to tell you about our friends over at Sleeper. We'll see you right after a quick word from our sponsor.
Sleeper is the number one fantasy sports app. It pays to know sports. Pick more or less on top players. Your first pick is on us, so start winning now. Play in Texas, Georgia, Minnesota, and 27 more states. Pick anytime across all sports, pregame or live. Over 10 million players are already on Sleeper. Make your picks count. Score up to 1,000 times your cash. Join today. Get up to $100 credit using code HMA. Call your shot on Sleeper. Download now.
All right. Our friends over at Sleeper, a proud sponsor of Lions Collective. It's a fantasy sports and real money gaming app focused on bringing people together. I'm assuming many of you have already used Sleeper. It's one of the fastest organically growing fantasy platforms in the entire world. It's got millions of users. And now they have Sleeper Picks, which if you're allowed to do so in your state, you should be using it. Very simple. You choose 2 to 8 of your favorite players from pregame, live, or even across different sports. You just pick more or less than the predicted stats on the app. And on Sleeper, you can get up to 1,000x payouts. Share it with your friends. Get rewarded together. Use the code HMA and get a $100 deposit. Up to $100.
I need to get on that, Jeff. My dynasty team just died. It's dead. James Conner, dead. Malik Nabers, dead. Trey Benson, dead.
Jane Daniels, too, right?
Yeah, he's been dead, but he got resurrected. A little Lazarus action going on there, but I think the rest of the squad's dead. I got to get a sleeper account.
Don't worry, Justin. I got Tyreek Hill. Dead. All
right. Yeah.
Dead.
Half the NFL is dead right now, dude. Honestly. It's a good segue into this.
I know. Guess what? Turns out it's not just the Lions. Who knew? Yeah.
Wow, how about that?
Yeah. Well, crazy. You know what? It's nice to see. Well, it's never nice to see an injury, but it is nice to see not season ending. Okay.
Is that what you're gonna say?
Are we live?
Yeah, let me guys, I'll get my way out of this. All right. I was working my way out. Just give me a sec. It's nice to see not season ending. Can we last year a lot of season ending injuries.
Yes.
DJ Reed, when he got carted off, I'm not gonna lie to you. I just looked down, I said, here we go. Season ending. It just looks so bad. And then you get news. He's on IR. There's no surgery required. Dan kind of talked about it. He's gonna be out a while. Terran Arnold, kind of a week to week, it seems like. This week, probably not going to play, but he could be back the following week. It didn't look too good when he was injured in the game. That's positive news. Davenport's still on IR. He's going to come off in a couple of weeks. Then you got Ali McNeil starting his clock this week. So some positive, along with some negative, but still some positive in there. At least these guys will be back at some point this season, which is good news.
I think based on where things were, like, it could have been a lot worse than the news that we ended up getting. Mm-hmm. Like, DJ, he spoke briefly in the locker room today, and he said that he thought he tore his hamstring off the bone after he got hurt there and thought his season was over. And it sounds like, you know, he was just placed on IR, so he's going to miss at least four games. His earliest chance to return would be, I believe, week 10 versus the Commanders, if that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see if he can come back at the early end of that timeline. But, you know, he thought it was going to be worse than it was. So I think that's good news there. Terrion sort of does this thing where he gets hurt and, like, we'll leave a game and then we'll think he's going to miss multiple weeks. And then he was out there practicing today. So he, at least on a limited basis, but I think that's sort of a positive sign for him, all things considered. Still not sure his status for Sunday's game, but I think the fact that he was out there is good news regardless. And then Aleem, man, I mean, Justin, I know you talked to Aleem not too long ago, but just the fact that Dan Campbell came out today and was like, yeah, we're starting this clock. That was like kind of what he let off with, it felt like. And it's like, all right, man, that's a shot in the arm full of energy. And it's like, he's like, I feel bad for the linemen that have to go up against him because, you know, Mac's back. And we went out there for practice. And one of the first songs they play is, you know, Return of the Mac. And, you know, everyone's having a good time out there. So, yeah, I think all things considered, you know, for what it could have been you lose DJ Reed for the season. Could have been Terrion Arnold maybe placed on IR with that shoulder injury. It doesn't seem like that's going to be the case. The fact that he was out there, that's good news. And then you're starting Aleem's clock. And I believe Campbell said on 97.1 that they would like to get him going before the bye week. And I think this sort of lines up with it timeline-wise. So that's good news all around for them.
When I saw Reed go down, I mean, it looked like he was shot in the ass, right? Like just the way he clutched the back of his leg and collapsed to the ground and, you know, it typical with his football character, right? Still tried to make the play while with his free hand. But they were really game planning around Reed and how good he was playing, right? Like last 2 weeks, and I know Will kind of brought up in the post game, we weren't really sure because sometimes you don't catch these things live, but it was the second week in a row he traveled, right? Like, so he traveled with Zay Flowers against Baltimore. He traveled with Jerry Jeudy here and gives up three receptions right off the bat. First drive of that game, three receptions, 48 yards. Doesn't give up another one. There was four more targets while he was in the contest. He broke up three of them, including a really, really incredible pick. I mean, there's no other way to describe that. He just overpowered, threw him, diving catch, unbelievable play. And you look at just some of the schemes they were running, some of these half-field zones where they were trusting him in man-on-man while the rest of the defense was playing zone coverage. Like, he was balling out. And it's a really, really tough loss to absorb. I think they're going to have to simplify some of their coverage schemes here. But the nice thing is Brad Holmes built some pretty good depth at cornerback. And, you know, it starts with Amik Robertson. I think everybody here is a fan of what he brings to the table, both quote-wise and performance-wise. you know, certainly played really, really well on the outside to finish last season, was better on the outside when he was in Vegas. I don't have any concerns about him there. And you know, I think Rockison is a really nice schematic fit if you need him, whether, you know, Terrion can go or not. Beyond that, like, look, nobody has great cornerbacks 5, 6, 7. Like, when it starts getting dicey and great, like, you could run Khalil Dorsey out there or Trey Flowers off the practice squad. But, like, in terms of their top four or five, like it's a really solid group, and I think they're going to be able to salvage this thing, you know, until Reed gets back.
Yeah, I think quickly on Terrion, after this coaching staff saw the way he tried playing through his hamstring back in week one and the way that it limited him, especially on those two explosive plays, they had no interest in letting him go back in that game Sunday with a compromised shoulder. And he actually seemed like Shep in the aftermath of the week one loss was like really frustrated with Terrion for almost keeping himself in the game at a time when he probably should have taken himself out because he wasn't at 100%. So they seemed to have no desire to leave him in at less than where they need him. I do think just watching him move around on the field today that he'll play on Sunday as early as it is to say that. But yeah, Justin, I agree. And I was going to make a version of the same point. I think given how well TA was playing in training camp and how highly the coaching staff thought of him, they were prepared to basically have DJ and TA each play one side of the field. And they had to adjust that approach after watching TA struggle pretty badly in weeks one and two and pivot to DJ being the guy who travels. And, you know, I fully expect Amik Robertson to draw the Ja'Marr Chase matchup on Sunday. And obviously it's different without Joe Burrow back there, but he can still make plays with the best of them, obviously. And I think the Lions feel a lot of confidence in Amik in that matchup based on the way he matched up with Justin Jefferson in last year's season finale. And I thought Amik, when he ended up matched up with Jerry Jeudy on last Sunday after DJ Reed went down, also held his own. And dude, like, you just can't not love Amik. Like, after that game ends, he's at his locker and he's got his pads still strapped. He's got a towel over his head. Listening to him speak, you would have thought he was like one of the culprits in a terrible performance. And they won by 24. And Amik actually played pretty darn well. I know he was pissed at himself for allowing the one deep ball down the sideline, for not snaring the pick that kind of slipped through his hands, and for maybe missing one tackle. But you go back and look at the numbers and they were very impressive all the way around. And, you know, anytime we as reporters walk into the Lions locker room, there's one guy who is always at his stall and always watching film on his tablet, and it's Amik Robertson. And he'll always make time for anyone who wants to come talk to him, which is everyone. But then he'll immediately go back to dissecting film. And there was a moment in the game on Sunday after Reed went down that stood out to me that I think kind of personifies Amik's ability to step up in those one-on-one matchups against receivers who are bigger than him, who are taller than him, and who might even be more explosive than him. Late in the game, Flacco tried hitting Jeudy on third down on sort of an out route towards the Lions sideline. And you could see Amik was reading it the whole way. And I think Flacco even knew who's reading it, because he eventually just chose to throw the ball kind of high and wide out of bounds so that Amik couldn't swoop in for the pick. And after the play ended, Amik, being Amik, was immediately in Jeudy's face, like right up in his grill, and was pointing at his own head over and over again. And so made a point to ask him about it after the game. And he was like, yeah, man, well, first of all, me and Jeudy go back to our days with the Raiders. And so I got right up in his face, and Jeudy was like, how you knew that was coming? How you knew that was coming? And Amik was like, I'm very smart. I'm very smart. and he really is, man. And he has instincts that I think shine more at corner than at nickel. And they shine more when he can play consistently, which he doesn't have the benefit of doing at nickel in a defense that plays so much base. So I think we will see him take his game to another level with this new opportunity. And look, he's the first one to say it. Like, I ain't ducking nothing. He wants every bit of that Ja'Marr Chase matchup on Sunday. And shoot, when you watch him out jump 6'4" Harold Fannin to knock down that jump ball in the first quarter or first half, you understand why he's able to match up with these bigger receivers, man. He's every bit of tenacious and ferocious that this Lions defense needs.
Where's that dude that intercepted 14 balls in 3 years in college, though? That's what I want.
Yeah,
lights at Ford Field, they just keep getting him. Like, I don't understand. Like, he was the play. I sought him out at the combine that year because the Lions had talked about needing guys that could turn the ball over. And I'm like, well, here's the guy. Like, this guy did it all through his college career. Where is that dude? Like that is the one thing lacking from his game. And it's not even like he's not there. Like how many have slipped through his fingers? Well, it blows my mind, given the ability to turn the ball over in college, why it just hasn't been there. We're, you know, now 21 games into his Lions career, 22, if you want to count the quarter he played in the playoffs. And still looking at that first one, Will. Still
it drives it one. Drives him crazy too.
I know.
It's starting to eat him alive. Like the more he talks about it, the more you can tell he's consumed by it. I mean, it's got to happen eventually. Why not against Jake Browning, who you know, kind of the interception purveyor. The one other point I wanted to make, because we mentioned Hutch earlier, is that like this now is when you really need your edge rushers and your pass rush as a whole to thrive. And one thing that like Anzalone was talking about after the game on Sunday is that like when Hutch is playing like he was against the Browns and wrecking the game and getting pressure pretty consistently, it makes their job in the back end so much easier. They know they really only have to cover for 2.5 to 3 seconds at the most versus 4 seconds, 5 seconds when that rush isn't getting home. And when you have that comfort in coverage, this goes for linebackers and cornerbacks alike, you can eliminate a lot of routes that you have to defend. And so you can be a little bit more aggressive. You can take a little bit more of maybe a risky approach to try and capitalize on a poor throw. And so when Hutch is getting home up front, man, it alleviates so much stress behind him.
Look, I know this is the Hutchinson show. I get it up front, but again, another shout out to what Shep's done in with Davenport out. You know, I really kind of like the looks they've done with O'Connor, Tyler Lacy out of nowhere on the edge. Thought he's played really, really well out there with that kind of power pocket crushing style. And then you bring Muhammad in on pass rushing situations. I think 19 of his 25 snaps were pass rush situations on Sunday, and he's doing some inside outside stuff. He's impacting the game, 4 pressures. Like I know we kind of all fretted and there was some hand wringing and some gnashing of teeth, if you will, when Davenport went out, but they've really found a nice mix, and they being Shep on how to cover that up and how to complement Hutchinson, I think, in the best possible way.
Shep has a really good feel for his personnel, and you can't often say that about a first-year DC, but I think it's because he's been here such a long time. He's seen all these guys grow up. He's been around the block with this roster. So I do like the fact that he looks at it from a linebacker's perspective, but also he's just putting every defensive lineman in position to succeed. I asked Campbell today, just like, you know, what is having like the man cover corners do to your defense? And it says it's like sort of a trickle-down effect where, you know, a quarterback has to make a perfect throw, and a lot of times – you know, when he's waiting for something to come open, that allows for a sack. So you really do see the rush and coverage work together. But I think a lot of that is, hey, when you got a guy like Hutch that's doing damage, it allows other guys to do their job, like Muhammad. So I really like the way that he's deploying his defensive personnel so far. And honestly, I'm looking at the Bengals right now, and that offensive line is hot trash. They allow the 5th highest pressure rate in the NFL at 42.6. I don't know if you watched that Broncos-Bengals game Monday night, which did not need to be a Monday night football game, by the way.
It did not need to be watched.
No. Why are you subjecting a national audience to that? I know Burrow was supposed to play.
It should have been good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know, but still. We need to get the flex in early in the season. Let's make that happen in the next deal or something like that. But there was a play in that game where I think the Broncos only rushed 3, and you had 4 guys blocking 1 person. So you had the 2 tackles having one-on-ones, and both of them lost within like half a second.
Badly, yeah.
Oh my goodness. I have a screenshot on Twitter. Please look that up if you're listening to this. But I worry about the Bengals offensive line, and I worry for Jake Browning in particular against this Lions front. So that could be ugly.
I'm super thankful that this is the week the Penei Sewell, Jamar Chase meme has resurfaced. Yeah. I don't know if anybody's seen that one where they show Penei Sewell blocking and throwing to any receiver. They're all stick figures, but Burrow throwing to any receiver, I think, is the label. And then there's any offensive tackle and Burrow getting destroyed as the ball goes half the distance to the Chase stick figures. It's great, but that's the case. And it's wild to me because they invested in that offensive line. They went out and they signed Orlando Brown and gave him a big deal. They signed a adequate starting guard in Ted Karras, and they used a first round and a third round pick on two really good Georgia offensive linemen, at least coming out in Mims and Fairchild, Fairfield, sorry, Dylan. But like either way, like they've invested. It's not like they're not trying, but it's just I described it as like the Bengals feel like they went to the grocery store and bought a bunch of shit with no plan to make dinner. Like, there's no plan. They just have a bunch of ingredients, and
it's like going to the grocery store hungry. It's like going to the grocery store hungry.
Yeah,
that's what that is.
Got chocolate chips and some ramen noodles,
right?
And this turkey gravy. I don't know. What are we making?
Yeah.
Campbell usually doesn't have much trouble listing all of the great players on opposing teams. I felt like he was kind of scrapping today to come up with a few names as he was running down all of the threats the Bengals have. And first of all, in typical Campbell fashion, mentions the defensive tackle or nose tackle every time without fail. He really is consumed with how much a defensive tackle can wreck a game plan. But once he got past Hendrickson, and started listing off some of these other guys by number as much as name, it just didn't sound all that convincing. But you know he's still going to get these guys fired up and ready to play, because it really never is about the opponent. It's about doing right by their own standards and their own expectations, and they just refuse to let those slip. I thought Scotty Montgomery said it well today. This was part of a larger JMO conversation, but he was like, he understands now that we are not allowed to walk past the standard, because once the standard slips, that's the new standard. And they keep it exactly where it needs to be every single week, no matter who they're playing. And we saw that all last year. We've already seen it this year. They scoff at the idea of a trap game. Like, why would we even entertain that notion? We have 17 chances over the course of a season to play as well as we possibly can on Sunday. Why would we expect ourselves to do anything less than that? So, yeah, I mean, I expect to see the same team Sunday that we've come to know now under Dan Campbell. And I was trying today to figure out ways that the Bengals can kind of make this a game just for the sake of conversation on this podcast. And I guess it involves like Jamar Chase and T. Higgins both going off, but that would have to involve Jake Browning having a huge day behind that offensive line against this front seven. And you're like, well, okay, that's not going to happen. And then you're like, okay, well, maybe Trey Hendrickson by himself can just wreck this game. But we just saw Taylor Decker hold his own against Myles Garrett last week. And we should note that Hendrickson, much like Garrett, rushes predominantly off of the right edge of the offensive line or the defensive line. So this again will be mostly Taylor Decker's matchup on Sunday. And you just feel good about that. I don't really know if I was a Bengals fan or even like a Bengals player or coach, how I would chart the path toward beating the Lions on Sunday.
Well, I guess it's the perfect segue right into the final segment of the show, the Dog and Pony Picks for Dog and Pony Show Brewery, where we get into our how we kind of think the game's going to go. Obviously, the Bengals don't have Joe Burrow, Jake Browning. Zach Taylor stands behind his guy. They can't protect him at all. How do we kind of think this game goes for the Lions here? Because we just got done talking at the beginning of the show how the Lions take care of opponents they're supposed to be, and now you have a team like the Bengals. I mean, go ahead.
I'm gonna go to our group chat today and point out that Will and I on our former podcast, we used to have some fun with this pick segment. And I would say, how many points, Will, do I have to give you to take the opposition? Because there was those weeks where they played the Titans or the Jaguars, where it's like, I mean, we know the Lions are gonna win. We know they're gonna take care of business because the standards are standards. So how many? I don't even know what the spread is, guys, but how many points would I have to give you?
It's like 10 and a half, by the way, something like
which
that.
Which doesn't feel like it's nearly
that's
enough.
That's not enough. So I'll give my prediction less. I want to hear how many points you need to take the Bengals this week.
Hey, first of all, Kyle, who's our good friend over at Dog and Pony Show Brewery, texted me today and said, if we're recording tonight, which we obviously are, that he was going to actually broadcast us at the brewery. So to anyone who might possibly be watching the Dog and Pony show, what up? I would recommend every single beer on the menu. In particular, I was a fan of the Colonel Lager. I was loving the sour that I had. I also brought home the Fest beer. That one was unreal. You really can't go wrong. So just have every single one of them. I would need as many points as Kyle sent us home in beers last time you were at Dog and Pony Show, which was 18 beers a pop, if I'm not mistaken. I would need 18 and a half points to be comfortable taking the Bengals in this game.
That's pretty good. I think I'm going higher than that. I think I need a few more beers. I'll go, I think 21. I think I need 21 to feel comfortable. They've lost their last two games, combined 76-13, I believe.
That's great, Bob.
Man, I mean, yeah, I'm going at least 21, and even that feels a little conservative, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
Yeah, they got to figure the Bengals are scoring a touchdown on the opening drive. That's
right. Yeah,
obviously.
Yeah,
no. So, and that's about it. Nothing spot.
Yeah, that's how the script goes. Yeah, you know what? I'll go Kobe. Give me 23 and a half. All right, the Lions are going to win this game by 24 points. I mean, I just don't see Jake Browning with this O-line doing anything. I honestly just don't see it. The Lions have proven they're going to take care of business, even if they're on the road for whatever reason. Sometimes they're better on the road. It just kind of happens that way. So in Cincy, they're going to take care of business. I think score prediction wise, I mean, I already said 24 points, so I guess I have to like kind of
do math
there.
Get it.
You know what? Just give me 37-10. I'll just do that. Why not? All right. Just they're scoring 30 plus points, and I don't see the Bengals getting anything past like 14. So all
Jeff right, didn't graduate second grade math, but I'm pretty sure 37 minus 10 is not 24.
Well, it's
it had to be more
at
than
least 24. No, I got you.
Hey. Second grade math. We're good. Yeah.
Right. I didn't make it past first, so I'm with you, bro.
Hey, Boston College. All right, tell me. All right, tell me there.
Give me 20 and a half points and 34-13.
34-13, you said?
Yeah.
Okay.
You want to copy it? Just copy paste?
No. I'm going to take Lions 31, Browns.
Oh, not even, wrong team.
Lions 31, Bengals 6. I don't think the Bengals score a touchdown on Sunday. I just don't. And I think we get to see Amik Robertson's very first interception with the Lions.
Oh, big prediction.
Love that, by the way. Shout out to Kyle. He's in the chat there. He says, you guys are on the big screen.
Oh, let's go. Hey, we're famous. We made it, fellas.
You know what? We made it. Shout out to Kyle, as always, for supporting the fellas over here at Lions Collective. And appreciate all you guys, as always. We got some score predictions in the chat. Drop your score predictions. And don't forget, we'll be back next Wednesday, of course, 6 o'clock. Every single Wednesday, Lions Collective is here, and you guys have been supporting it. It's been amazing. So like the stream, hit subscribe, and we will catch you next Wednesday. But until then, peace.
Peace.